Good morning. My name is Janetta, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Changing Landscape for Women conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the call over to Ms. Cashin. You may begin.
Thank you, Janetta. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today for this overview of the Barbara Lee Family Foundation's new research on women's gubernatorial campaigns. My name is Allie Cashin. I'm the communications manager here at the Barbara Lee Family Foundation, and my contact information should be on all of your press materials, but in case it is not, you can get in touch with me by emailing acashin, A-C-A-S-H-I-N, at barbaralee.com. And certainly get in touch with me if you need any follow-up information after this call or if you want to request an interview with any of the participants. I am going to turn things over to Barbara to begin with, but keep in mind that the call is muted throughout the presentation, and then we'll open things up to the Q&A. Barbara?
Great. Thanks, Allie. So thank you again, everyone, for joining us on the call today of our discussion of our latest research on women's campaigns for governor. My name is Barbara Lee, and I am the founder and president of the Barbara Lee Family Foundation, and we work to advance women's equality and representation in American politics through political research, strategic partnerships, grants, and endowments. And with us on the phone today is Celinda Lake, president of Lake Research Partners, a leading Democratic polling firm. Celinda is one of the Democratic Party's leading strategists and tacticians. And we are also joined by Bob Carpenter, who is vice president of American Viewpoint, a leading Republican research firm. Bob has also worked at all levels of government and has extensive experience in state party management, campaign management, and legislative affairs. So together with Celinda and Bob and our other research partners at Hughes & Company, my foundation has studied and published nonpartisan research about every woman's gubernatorial race since 1998. And although we study governors, our research has been valuable to thousands of women candidates and elected officials at all levels and across parties. Over the years, we have found that there is a complex relationship between gender and campaigns for executive office, and I'm sure that's not a surprise to any of you on this call, but what may be surprising is how that relationship has evolved. 2010 was a turning point for us in our 12 years of research on women's campaigns for governor. Women last year ran on a more level playing field. And in fact, women candidates showed some distinct advantages over men. More on that in a minute. I first want to give you a little background. When I first started this research, only 16 women had ever served as governor. And today, that number has grown to 34. But you still have to compare that to 2,319 men. Last year, 10 women ran for governor across the country. 4 women won, all Republican. And that leaves us today with 6 women governors in total. As we all know, the 2010 election was the most partisan election in recent history, and party identification drove most voter decisions. However, after partisanship, we found that likability was the single most important predictor of votes for women. And likability is what you think it is. It's a voter's favorable impression of a candidate. In 2010, voters wanted candidates who were problem solvers, had the right priorities, and showed strength. And this was a change from past years when voters prioritized toughness, a trait which favored men. As one campaign consultant we worked with noticed, you know that women can manage things pretty well because they are moms and wives, and I think that's strength. The second big turning point in our research was on the economy. The economy was the single most important issue for women and men to master in 2010. And voters did not disadvantage women candidates on economic issues the way they have in the past. One consultant we interviewed said that in bad times, voters felt women understood pocketbook issues and would level with them. As I noted earlier, women are running on a more level playing field and have distinct advantages over men in campaigns. Now more than ever, gender can be a strategic asset for women candidates. Women can be 360-degree candidates. By using all of their expertise and experiences, women now have a broader range of opportunities to connect with voters. Campaign professionals in 2010 talked about a women candidate's ability to be relatable and to use everything in campaigns, including personal experience. One campaign manager noted that women candidates can be tough and policy-minded and still talk to people about their kids. In the past, women candidates were advised to avoid talking about their families. Voters were often uncomfortable with the idea of women candidates to begin with, and especially uncomfortable with women candidates who had young children. In 2000, in that election, Heidi Heitkamp came up against this when she ran for governor in North Dakota against a male opponent. And when asked about how old her children were, she responded with humor, "They're the same age as my opponent's kids." In addition to being more well-rounded candidates, we also found that voters still give women a slight advantage on honesty and ethics. And we saw this advantage in our first research in 1998, but it has lessened as women candidates have become more mainstream. In 2010, this honesty advantage was most noticeable for Democratic women running against Republican men. Knowing that women candidates have an advantage on honesty and ethics, male opponents last year tried to knock women candidates off their pedestals by launching negative attacks early on in their campaigns. And a woman candidate who falls off her pedestal pays a higher price with voters. When we first started this research, male candidates were hesitant to launch negative attacks against women opponents. Now they have no qualms about it, and it's an enormous challenge for women candidates to defend themselves. This is especially true when it comes to going negative. Voters penalize women candidates more than men when they believe they are engaged in negative campaigning. Voters see negative campaigning by a woman candidate as a sign that she is just a typical politician, eliminating any other gender advantages. This was a major stumbling block for Libby Mitchell's campaign for governor in Maine. In an independent expenditure, the Maine Democratic Party accused a third-party candidate of having been a lobbyist for oil companies and for China. And one male piece said, "Mainers might as well learn Chinese." Well, in Maine politics, this was pretty offensive. And even though Libby's campaign wasn't responsible for the male piece, voters blamed her. The Portland Press-Herald reported that voters disliked it so much that the third-party candidate actually won votes because of it. Before I hand things over to Celinda and Bob, I want to mention our findings about younger women voters. A decade ago, younger women were a reliable voting bloc, but today, women candidates can no longer count on greater support from younger women. In fact, in 2010, women ages 18 to 34 said they were interested in women candidates, but that did not predict their vote. One younger woman from our focus groups talked about electing competent people, period. She went on to say, "I'm having a hard time with the gender thing. When I was a little girl, I don't remember seeing a whole lot of women, and so we have seen that in our lifetime, but at this point, it's a non-issue to me." It may have been a non-issue to her, but it is a serious issue for women candidates. So now let me hand things off to Celinda and Bob to take a closer look at our findings.
Well, thank you very, very much, and I really want to commend the Lee Family Foundation for what has become really the most comprehensive understanding of women running for executive office, and over the course of the last 12 years, has included, as Barbara said, focus groups, pre-election surveys, post-election surveys, modeling, looking in depth at a variety of issues that have emerged, like honesty and ethics, toughness, likability, the economy, young women, in really providing us with an unparalleled understanding of this phenomena, and in what is still, other than president, the toughest office for women to emerge into. What we're going to present, Bob and I are going to present, are the findings from the pre- and post-election surveys. And we did surveys in every state, pre-election surveys in California, Florida, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and South Carolina, with oversamples of younger women voters. And then we did post-election studies in every state that had a woman run for governor: California, Florida, New Mexico, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Maine, Arizona, Wyoming, Wisconsin, and Vermont. Wisconsin and Vermont being our two control states, our states with men's races, so that we could compare how men versus men ran versus women versus men. And of course, 2010 was a very rich environment because we had a number of women running both on the Democratic and the Republican side. Also in the post-election studies, and Bob will talk about this in more detail, we had oversamples of younger women so that we could look in depth at younger women, and younger women here defined as 18 to 34. We also did focus groups in New Mexico and Oklahoma, the two women races, to really begin to explore that phenomena, as well as looking at Latinas and younger women, as well as women and male voters overall. So I think you'll agree, truly an unparalleled in-depth study. So the first thing we found about the 2010 elections is that, as Barbara said, they were uniquely partisan elections. And partisanship was by far the hardest driver of the vote. It also drove a number of perceptions of candidates, and it tended to drown out gender as a factor. Partisanship was so powerful. That being said, however, independent women voters still voted more for women candidates than independent men did. So once you controlled for partisanship, independent women voted for women candidates more than independent men did. That's a very important finding for the 2012 elections, because independent women will truly determine who will win the 2012 elections. They will be the key swing voters. Most of the partisan patterns worked against Democrats, male or female, in 2010. So it was very hard for Democrats to be perceived as change agents, very hard for Democrats to be perceived as tough, very hard for Democrats to be perceived as good on the economy, whether you were male or female. That was the driving force. That being said, as we'll discuss, as we looked at all the races, we still found some very interesting differences, and some differences from what we found in the past. And as Barbara has said, and as they've titled the report, this really is a kind of turning point and a kind of maturing of women's candidacies, where you see some of the traditional double binds that women were in diminishing or dissipating. Voters do believe that there is a lack of women candidates, although there's not a great deal of intensity around it. There used to be quite a bit of hunger for women, and it used to give a boost to their vote. This year, whether or not you cared about if there were enough women candidates did not particularly predict to the vote. Moreover, younger women who expressed the most interest in there being too few women candidates, actually, when you control for everything else, didn't vote particularly for women candidates. And that's the third cycle in a row that we found that. In 2006, 2008, and 2010, younger women were not particularly supportive of women candidates. Actually, baby boomer women, controlling for all else, were more likely to vote for women candidates. Interestingly, we asked a question about how would your friends and neighbors vote, excuse me, which we found in the 2008 election was really a very accurate predictor of vote, more accurate than people's own preferences expressed for themselves when it came, for example, to voting for an African-American president. So we looked at the same thing for a woman candidate, and we found that majorities of voters said that their friends and neighbors would have no preference, that there was a slight preference, actually perceived preference among their friends and neighbors for a male candidate, and that younger women found that even more true than older women voters. So again, we see, while people say there are not enough women in office, that doesn't predict to their vote. We also asked whether you see men and women as governing differently, and that does predict to people's votes. And it's a very important strategy for the future because men and women do introduce different bills. They do govern in different styles, as the Center for American Women in Politics, supported by the Barbara Lee Foundation, has demonstrated. Unfortunately, voters, while their attitudes about whether men or women govern differently, if they thought they governed differently, it predicted to them being more likely to vote for a woman, not that many people saw women candidates as governing that differently. And the great irony is that people with the most experience with women candidates were less likely to see them as governing differently. So there's getting to be a phenomena here where women are perceived as more typical and they're losing some of their advantage because of that, and demonstrating that we still don't have enough women, that women govern differently than men, an important part of getting more women into office, particularly into these electoral offices. The second very important point that we found in this study, and this is the second cycle in a row where we found this, is that likability was the most important predictor of voting for a woman candidate. And we had an interesting comparison with our male-male races, because in our male-male races, the candidate that was liked the best didn't necessarily get the most votes. Voters tended to vote for the candidate that they thought would be most effective. But when a woman was running, they voted, likability was the strongest predictor, then followed by effectiveness. Many of the same traits predicted likability and effectiveness, being strong, having the right priorities, being change-oriented, sharing your values, and some of the same traits predicted against likability, being perceived to run a negative campaign, which women still pay a higher price for, and being seen as a typical politician, which Bob will talk about. But in all but one of the races where there was a woman candidate, the candidate that was liked more on election day was the one who actually won the election. So likability, a very, very important trait for women to maintain and predicting more strongly to their vote than to the vote for men. One of the toughest problems for women candidates has been whether they are tough enough. And that has been a dominant trait that we've seen predicting the vote in all of the cycles before the 2010 cycle, although it had been diminishing in power slightly toward the end of the 2008 cycle. Male voters in particular thought and feared that women could not be tough enough, which is greatly ironic given those of us who actually work with these women, we know they're tough as nails. But it's also hard, given the previous finding, it's hard to be tough and maintain your likability. The Lee Foundation investigated a lot in the past. How can women appear tough and still maintain their likability? And they discovered things like slaying a dragon, taking on a special interest, fighting hard for your family, being an attorney general. All of those contributed to toughness. The most important thing, though, about the 2010 cycle was almost a maturing of the electorate vis-a-vis women candidates, and we found that toughness did not predict to the vote. Strength did, but toughness did not. And strength, a much, much easier trait for women to demonstrate than toughness. Two new themes emerged in 2010 that were very powerful, and actually an independent work that we've done in 2011 have continued to be powerful to voters, and that is being problem solvers and having the right priorities. These were traits that voters really gave great weight to in electing women. They were important also because they helped predict to likability, and they were important because these are traits that women have an advantage on. Unlike being tough, where voters tend to think it's very difficult for a woman to be as tough as a man and still be likable in particular, voters tend to think that women are better problem solvers and that women are more likely to set the right priorities. And we see this emerging, for example, in some of the budget debates in the 2011 legislative session, where voters have really given a very high ranking to elected leaders that they thought were setting the right priorities. They thought, you know, anybody, any seventh grader can go to the state legislature or to Congress and do across-the-board cuts. We're looking for leaders who can set the right priorities. So that was a very important trait and a powerful thematic for women. The last thing is that women candidates did not automatically receive outsider status. And that, of course, relates to the phenomena that we've seen that voters, even though there haven't been very many women governors, tend to think with Sarah Palin, with Michelle Bachmann, with Hillary Clinton, it's much more common now to have women running. It was particularly difficult for Democrats to be outsiders. Partisanship, much, much more than gender, predicted to whether or not you were perceived to be an outsider. And women didn't have the outsider status that they've automatically had in the past because voters think it's getting more typical to have women running for office. So some good news and some bad news, but some changes certainly in how voters are perceiving women candidates, what's predicting to their vote, and trends that we'll want to see in future elections if they continue. Let me turn it over to Bob to cover the rest of the story.
I'm going to touch on three issues. One is the economy, one is honesty and ethics, and the other, as Celinda mentioned briefly, the young women and how they came out in the 2010 election. Before I begin, though, let me echo Celinda's comments about the Lee Family Foundation and the leadership role they've taken in this this research, as well as thank Barbara and her team for really spearheading this and continuing to stay on top of the issue and ultimately helping female candidates across the country, both Republican and Democrat, in their efforts to become the chief executive of their state. As Barbara mentioned, the economy was the single most important issue for both men and women to master in 2010. And credibility on the economy was very important for any candidate. In 2008, women of both parties really struggled on the issue. In 2010, it was particularly difficult for Democrats, both male and female, to talk about and have gained credibility on the economy. In 2010, we found that voters did not disadvantage women candidates on economic issues. And their perceptions of candidates' attention to and effectiveness on the economy appeared tied more to partisanship than to candidate gender, and we really saw that on Election Day. In 2010, unlike past years, issues carried more weight than traits in determining the vote for both male and female candidates, with the economy being particularly dominant, as we saw. Voters say that issuing a plan for the economy and talking about experience and background in public office dealing with the economy were important items for conferring economic expertise, and breaking through on the economy by running ads detailing an economic platform was also important, though Democrats had a more difficult time than Republicans in breaking through. Democratic men and women both had difficulty on economic issues, such as making it easier to start a business, on jobs in the economy, on taxes, and creating a favorable business climate. And this was a major vulnerability in 2010, but it was driven more by partisanship than by gender. Republicans across the states that we looked at held an advantage on creating a favorable business climate and making it easier to start and run a business. And Republican women were really able to accentuate the Democratic disadvantage on starting and running a business. For Democratic women, talking about public sector experience on the economy was a strong point. For Republican women, issuing a written plan and running an ad on the economy were most predictive of credibility. So again, Democratic women talking about public sector experience versus Republican women issuing a plan and running an ad on the economy. For Democratic women running against Republican women, getting endorsements on the economy was very important in establishing credibility. For Republican women women versus women states, running an ad on the economy and focusing on private sector experience were most predictive of credibility. In terms of honesty and ethics, voters still give women an advantage on this dimension. But voters penalize women when they believe they are engaged in negative campaigning, as Barbara mentioned in the main example. In 2010, Democratic women running against Republican men had this honesty advantage, but Republican women running against Democratic men trailed slightly. And being seen as honest and ethical were predictive for the Democratic women when facing a Republican man, and for Republican women when facing a Democratic man. Democratic women who faced a Republican man enjoyed a large lead on the ethics issue. Looking at young voters, and Celinda touched on this briefly, as did Barbara, women candidates can no longer count on greater support from young voters, in particular young women voters. Women age 18 to 34 said that they were interested in women candidates, but that did not predict their vote. Young women were more likely to say they wanted to vote for the woman due to her gender, but their actual vote behavior was quite opposite. And in fact, baby boomer women were more supportive of women candidates, all things considered, than younger women for the third cycle in a row, as Celinda mentioned. They expressed a slightly elevated interest in women candidates in some areas, though our multivariate analysis reveals that candidate gender does not drive their voting behavior. Younger women were particularly likely to say that their neighbors would prefer a man, which oftentimes is predictive of their vote. When we ask, you know, how would your neighbor react to this, or how would your spouse react, or how would your coworker react, and they give us an answer, many times we can predict that what they're saying is how they truly feel. The majority of young women do not feel it's important to support women running for office simply because they're a woman. They feel it's even less important to support a person of color or a younger candidate due to their race or age. In terms of support for a woman merely because she was a woman, 72% in California said it was less or not important. 71% in Arizona, 66% in Florida, Maine, and New Mexico, 60% in South Carolina and Wyoming, and 55% across all states said that it was less or not important among younger women. Younger women saying 55% of younger women. Young women give Republican women who face Democratic men large advantages on being political outsiders, being tough, and less likely to be typical politicians. They also give Republican women significant advantages on a number of fiscal and economic dimensions, like making it easier to start and run a business, creating a favorable business climate, and managing the state budget. As I mentioned, issuing a written plan and talking about their experience and background in public office as it relates to the economy are most important items for conferring economic expertise to young women. And finally, young women credit Democratic women with honesty and ethics and believe they are less likely to run a negative campaign. Barbara?
If that's the end of the remarks, then I think we can open things up for Q&A. Operator, can you open the line for questions? And I would just ask that whoever does ask a question, please identify yourself, say your name and the outlet that you represent.
At this time, if you'd like to ask an audio question, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your first audio question comes from the line of Kathy Sanders.
Hey, this is Katie Sanders. I was wondering what you could share, if you could share any findings about the Alex Sink campaign in Florida. This is for anybody who...
The way we do this analysis is not to particularly analyze any individual race, and in fact, what we promise the candidates is actually anonymity in terms of their individual races. Because what we're looking at are the patterns across races.
Okay.
Katie, this is Allie Katzen. Is there something that you in particular were wondering about Alex's race that has to do with the research?
That's fine. If I think of something, I'll email you. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I did want to just say, again, we had a couple of women who really were extraordinary, you know, in the area of their economic credentials, like Alex and Meg Whitman.
Your next audio question comes from the line of Kyle Cheney.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if there was any sort of conclusions to draw from whether women candidates faced either, you know, a difficult multi-candidate primary versus an uncompetitive primary in which they were sort of the, you know, establishment candidate. Was there anything predictive in those type of races?
Oh, that's a really good question. Most of the women faced primaries of one kind or another. But whether or not you had a primary didn't particularly predict to the results. We do know that, and actually the Center for American Women in Politics has documented this, that women do face primaries, competitive primaries, more than men, there wasn't anything particularly gender derivative of women in primaries this time. What was a little bit different than we've seen in the past is traditionally women have had an easy time getting out of Democratic primaries and a tougher time getting out of Republican primaries, in part because the Democratic electorate is about 59, primary electorate is about 59% female, and the Republican primary electorate averages around 45-48% female. This time, Republican women were quite successful coming out of their primaries, and Bob can speak to that more than I can. And actually, Democratic women had more difficulty coming out of their primaries than they have in the past. But whether or not you had a primary didn't particularly predict to the general election.
Yeah, this is Bob. I would just follow up on that. And when you look at the Republican female candidates across the board, they were all relatively successful for different reasons. Meg Whitman in California ran a campaign, and it's no secret that she spent a fair amount of her own money. Nikki Haley, on the other hand, in South Carolina, ran as a real outsider and was successful in that way. So they all looked at the campaigns all looked at the strengths that they possessed going into it. And ran on those strengths.
Once again, to ask an audio question, press star 1.
Well, while we're waiting for people to queue up, there's one thing in particular that I found striking about the research, which is the drop-off in support of younger women voters, and was wondering if folks could hazard a guess as to the motivation for younger women dropping off their support for voters, and maybe why that would be that younger women are less likely to support women candidates at this point.
Your next audio question comes from the line of Paul Dettard.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the same thing, especially to you, Celinda. Is this disappointing?
Oh, well, I think it's clearly disappointing, particularly to the women candidates. I think you expect younger women and hope younger women will be more supportive. Baby boomer women are more supportive of women candidates still. And I think the primary reason for it is that younger women do not perceive, it's kind of like on the choice question, they don't perceive it to be that unusual to have women running. And if you think about it, they're coming out of college where, you know, the colleges are now working hard not to have 60% plus women. They're maybe going into graduate school, the same thing. They're often women get involved in, nonprofit sector, which is now dominated by women's leadership. Although it's interesting, the new study has come out that showed that, presidents of student body are not necessarily heavily female, so we see some of the same tracking politically. But young women are used to women being in leadership positions and then also very influenced by the emergence of very, strong, vivid women candidates in Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, and I think one of the major things is they just don't perceive there to be that much of a problem that we have a lot of women running. We have, you have Hillary, you have Sarah. What's the problem?
Well, and I would add to that former Speaker Pelosi.
Yes, absolutely. Good point.
Right, and this is Barbara. One of the other things is that, again, young women, because of this high prominence and high visibility of a few number of very prominent women, most people don't realize the small percentage of women who are actually in politics. So, again, we have 6 out of 50 governors and only 16% of women in Congress. People in Congress are women. And so people are shocked when they get that information. It is a big surprise to them about women's underrepresentation. The other issue is that we see that women win just as often as men when they run, but there is a smaller number of women running.
Can I ask one other question? Is this trend offset by men voters who no longer look at women as somebody they don't want to vote for just because of their gender?
Well, independent women do vote more for women than independent men. So 2010 was so driven by partisanship that it's hard to figure this out. But it does look like there was some lagging among independent men, countered by some support among independent women. We didn't look at younger men.
Okay.
So we don't know where that is, and that's a very interesting question. But I think the other thing about younger women is that, I think voters in general have no idea that we actually lost in terms, in the 2010 elections, we actually saw a decline in the number of women in state legislatures and a decline in the number of women in Congress. So not only do we not have that many, but 2010 actually made things worse. So I think it's a very interesting question if greater awareness of that phenomena would also motivate and mobilize more younger women.
And if I could add to that, and the research did not look at this Senate candidates, but there's been 39 female members of the United States Senate in our country's lifetime, 17 of which are currently serving. So if you think about 18 to 34-year-olds, more than half of the women that have served in the U.S. Senate have served or are serving in this 18 to 34 period's lifetime. So, again, having female in office is not the rarity that it was, you know, even 20 or 30 years ago.
Your next audio question comes from the line of Courtney Albany.
Hi, my name is Courtney Albini, and I'm representing American Enterprise Institute. And I was wondering if you could shed a little more light on your analysis that women, although have the advantage in ethics, have a bigger fault when it comes to violating those ethics. So negative, if they direct negative campaigns, that's going to be a bigger pitfall than as if a man would.
Sure. I mean, what we have seen, it's out of character for women to run negative campaigns. So when they do, it tends to backfire on them. The honesty and you know, they pay a price for that negative campaigning. They see it as a clear indication that the female is a typical politician, so that eliminates any gains that they may have gotten. The likability, as we saw in this research, was so important that negative campaigning denigrates that likability. And you know, it's a fine line you're walking in terms of critiquing an opponent's record, their priorities or their decisions without being seen as running a negative campaign. And it's quite honestly, it's more difficult for women to do that than men. That, you know, we've just seen over time, people want to respect the woman in office, and if they are perceived as running a negative campaign, the likability factor is eroded and they're seen as a typical politician.
Just a follow-up. I know you don't look at
that. If I can add just one thing on that, I want to be clear that, you know, if you're behind, if you're spending less money, if you're trying to get rid of an incumbent, if you're a minority party, you're going to have to run a negative campaign. So we're not advising people not to run negative campaigns because they're going to have to. The issue is the voter's perception of you running a negative campaign. And so there are a variety of ways to deal with that, not delivering the negative message in your own voice, having third-party validators for the contrast on the issues. You know, it's tried and true now to start an ad, why is your opponent running a negative campaign? Because they want to hide their own record so that in the process you attribute to your opponent the negative campaigning. So there are a variety of methods, and I think, you know, further research would help to identify even more where women candidates deal with this, but we're not recommending not running negative campaigns. We're just warning that, like so many other areas, it's kind of a double bind, and women have to do it better.
As a quick follow-up, I know that you you don't analyze individual elections, but do you think this may have had a big impact on the Meg Whitman campaign in California in terms of being having a huge economic advantage over Jerry Brown, but then being slammed for her negative ads?
Once again, to ask an audio question, press star 1.
I'm not an expert on the Meg Whitman campaign. I don't know, Bob, if you want to answer that. Again, our research is really looking for the patterns across races rather than analyzing individual races.
And I think it's important to, when you're looking at an individual race, you have to look at the totality of that race. And, there was a lot going on in California, as there always is in any election cycle. You know, partisanship played a big role in this election, and the partisan advantage the Democrats hold in California should not be underestimated.
At this time, we have no further audio questions.
Okay, then thank you everyone for joining us. Again, my name is Allie Cashin, and I'm the Communications Manager with the Barbara Lee Family Foundation. If you have any questions or if you would like to try to arrange a one-on-one interview with anyone who's been on the call, certainly feel free to send me an email at acashin, A-C-A-S-H-I-N, at blff.org, and also visit our website at barbaraleefoundation.org. Thanks so much.
Great. And this is Barbara. I again want to thank Celinda and Bob for all the work that you've done with us and all of my people on Team Lee who I know are also listening into this call. And you've done great work for us and, you know, looking forward to moving forward and taking information out. And thank each and every one of you for being on the call and listening to us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank you for joining today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.